Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dr. Helen Caldicott, anti-nuclear activist and co-founder of Physicians for Social Responsibility, who discusses the provocations which she believes led to North Korea's recent nuclear weapons test. Investigative reporter Robert Parry, who examines the Foley congressional sex scandal and how the Republican spin machine has attempted to launch a counterattack. And former Connecticut Democratic Congressman Sam Gaydenson, who analyzes the political tactics of moderate Republicans like Christopher Shays as they fight to retain their seats in November's congressional election. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the midst of tense peace talks, the United Nations Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights has accused Maoist rebels in Nepal of continuing to violate the human rights of people under their control. The Maoist insurgency is in negotiations with Nepal's interim government, formed by the seven-party alliance after Nepal's monarch, King Janendra, stepped aside in April. The new government signed a ceasefire with the rebels, ending a decade-long war that killed nearly 13,000 people. Despite the ceasefire, the UN Human Rights Agency claims the rebels continue to abuse the rights of civilians. For example, 8 people were killed in recent months after actions taken by rebel-controlled people's courts. The UN report also recounts the case of Fuli Devi Yadav and her husband after they returned to Nepal following the ceasefire. She was punished for remarrying following the death of her first husband and beaten by the Maoists in public. She later died from poisoning. The report also found 184 people have been abducted by rebels since the ceasefire went into effect, with several committing suicide while in custody. Government and rebel negotiators have agreed to hold an election in mid-2007 to elect a body to write a new constitution. But stark differences of opinion remain over the fate of the monarchy and disarming the rebels. Although not unexpected, the murder of Russian journalist Anna Politkovskaya on Saturday, October 7th, was a grave loss to independent media. 48-year-old Politkovskaya was found shot in the head in her apartment building elevator. Over the past 10 years, she reported primarily for Novaya Gazeta on the brutality of the Chechen War and the torture, mass executions, rape, and kidnapping of civilians perpetrated by Russian soldiers. Politkovskaya had received death threats in the past few years, but she never allowed them to interfere with or compromise her journalistic integrity. Her latest book is titled Putin's Russia, which indicts Russia for its political corruption and is now available in the U.S. Some now fear the independent Novaya Gazeta will be the next target of attacks. But according to The Nation magazine, in a little-noted development, last June, former Russian President Mikhail Gorbachev became a minority partner shareholder in Novaya. It is speculated that his involvement may provide some protection from any Kremlin attempts to silence the paper's voice. Politkovskaya received many journalistic awards and took many more risks. She leaves behind 2 children and is the 42nd journalist to be killed in Russia since 1992. Russia has yet to conduct any investigations or bring to justice those responsible for the murders. Over the last decade, a new generation of white, working-class, and religious so-called Sam's Club Republicans has emerged. In contrast to the conservative establishment, they support government intervention in the economy and helping the poor. The new group, based mostly in southern and western states, has put traditional small government advocates in a bind. To further cement the alliance of the Sam's Club GOP, some conservative thinkers are talking about a new economic agenda for families, including subsidies for childcare, stay-at-home moms, and single men. According to the American Prospect magazine, the new pro-government conservatives support the minimum wage, think corporations have too much power, and are skeptical of tax cuts for the rich. The successful 20-year conservative formula of tax cuts and starving the beast of big government may be running out of steam. Yet Democrats, long advocates of domestic programs, may not benefit from the new political shift. Most blue-collar conservatives see the Democrats as the party of the poor and not the defender of the middle class. The Democrats have more work to do to show the public they really care about working Americans and are willing to take on corporate power. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Denise Manzari. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The world greeted North Korea's claim that it had successfully tested a nuclear weapon on October 8th with initial skepticism, condemnation, and the threat of sanctions. President Bush, who had years earlier stated that the U.S. would not tolerate a nuclear-armed North Korea, focused concern on the possibility that the isolated nation would share its nuclear technology with other countries or terrorist groups. The president described that potential action as a grave threat to the United States. In the UN Security Council, Washington is attempting to gain consensus support for the imposition of sanctions on Pyongyang, which include an international arms embargo, a ban on all trade relating to weapons of mass destruction, and a freeze on funds linked to North Korea's missile and nuclear programs. The U.S. proposal would authorize international inspection of cargo to and from North Korea to prevent the government of Kim Jong-il from exporting its nuclear technology. Shortly after taking office, President Bush shunned direct negotiations with North Korea and after 9/11 declared the nation as part of the Axis of Evil. In its nuclear posture review, leaked in 2002, the Bush administration included North Korea on a list of nations as potential targets for a future U.S. nuclear attack. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dr. Helen Caldicott, a pediatrician and a longtime activist with the international anti-nuclear movement. Dr. Caldicott discusses the provocations which she believes led to North Korea's nuclear weapons test and what can be done to stop nuclear proliferation.
There's an article in the New York Times after the test to say they're not really sure if it was a nuclear test. So I'm going to maintain my skepticism until it's been definitively proved one way or another. Now, if they did blow up a nuclear weapon, it's exactly what the Pentagon's been wanting and Dick Cheney, because there was an agreement formulated between Bill Clinton called the Agreed Framework in 1994 to say, look, if you don't make bombs, we'll allow you to build two light water nuclear power plants. We'll supply with heavy fuel for the winter. We'll help you with food, which they desperately need because they're such a poverty-stricken country. And we will... what they really want from America is America to sign a non-aggression treaty that they won't bomb them, and America will not. So Clinton had that tied up, and he could have flown to North Korea the night or the day before the election took place, which elected George Bush, and he failed to do that. Something else came up. If he'd done this, this would not have happened. And then what happened was that Kim Dae-jung, who is the president of South Korea, was having what he called a sunshine policy, which is to establish relationships with North Korea. Many families in both Koreas, they belong to each other, yet they can't see each other. And so he came to Washington about 6 months after Bush was first elected, and he was totally shunned by the White House, totally. And it was such an insult to him and to North Korea and what he was trying to do. They really set him up and the whole situation for North Korea to be really angry. And then George Bush gave that speech, Axis of Evil speech. So they've been pushing and prodding and pushing and prodding them. And finally, North Korea left the non-proliferation treaty. It kicked out the weapons inspectors. And, you could have predicted, because Kim Jong-il clearly isn't terribly balanced. He's, I think, probably clinically paranoid. And he did what everyone expected him to do and actually, I think, wanted him to do.
So you think the United States deliberately provoked North Korea into taking this path to going forward with this nuclear weapons program?
I don't think so. They did. They even talk about it. If you read my book, The New Nuclear Danger, George Bush's Military-Industrial Complex, I've documented the articles and the statements from the Pentagon. So they've used North Korea for about 40 years to justify having nuclear weapons. Cheney or Rumsfeld used North Korea in his missile defense program, saying they might build a missile, therefore we're going to set up a missile defense, which is really against Russia and has nothing to do with North Korea. The Pentagon have been playing war games for 40 years, like if North Korea invades South Korea, what do we do? And it always ends up in nuclear war. So North Korea is a very useful instrument for the Pentagon to justify what they're doing. And also, the hypocrisy takes my breath away. Of the 30,000 nuclear weapons in the world today, Russia and America own 97% of them. 97%. and they both have each other on hair trigger alert. And if by accident they launch their weapons, you know, that the nuclear war's over in an hour and we're all dead. In fact, most of the planet is dead. So the real rogue states in the world are Russia and America, which no one will talk about. No one is talking about it.
Dr. Caldicott, the Associated Press reports that U.S. diplomats at the United Nations are circulating some ideas for a Security Council resolution containing sanctions against North Korea. Do you think these sanctions will do any good? And if not, what do you think a solution for nuclear proliferation is?
It's a poverty-stricken country. People, millions of people are desperately poor and not getting enough to eat. What North Korea wants more than anything else is to sit down with the Bush administration and talk to them. And in fact, Jim Baker has just come out with a report about Iraq, but he's saying that, you know, what America needs to do is sit down and talk to these nations. I mean, how dare America refuse to talk to the North Koreans? And instead they brought in a six-party talks, including Japan, Russia, South Korea, China. But you know what North Korea wants is America to sit down and negotiate directly with them and sign a non-aggression treaty promising that they will never invade or bomb North Korea again. And instead of doing that, no one will talk to her. And so she's done the obvious thing that any paranoid country would do, which is to say, well, to hell with you, we'll make our own bomb. And if they have, that's why. So if you look at the psychological dynamics and the political dynamics behind what has just happened, it's very obvious why they did it, and it's very obvious how you can fix it. You just go over there and sit down and say, okay, what do you want? Let's talk.
That was Dr. Helen Caldicott, co-founder of Physicians for Social Responsibility and author of Nuclear Power is Not the Answer. Contact Dr. Caldicott's Nuclear Policy Research Institute at area code 202-822-9800. Or visit their website at www.nuclearpolicy.org. The scandal surrounding Florida Congressman Mark Foley's improper advances to underage male pages and allegations that the Republican leadership had swept the matter under the rug has become the major news story in the weeks before the critical midterm congressional election, November 7th. Public outrage over the scandal has further diminished the standing of the GOP, which is already facing a tough fight to retain control of the House and Senate in the coming election. While the story resonates with many voters in that it confirms the public perception of a corrupt Congress guilty of multiple abuses of power, the news media's obsession with the Mark Foley affair has chased many other far more important issues off the front page, such as the escalating violence in Iraq and Afghanistan, and Congress's recent legalization of torture and elimination of habeas corpus from the U.S. Constitution. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with investigative journalist Robert Perry, who reviews the Foley scandal and how the Republican spin machine has gone on the counterattack, creating fear in eyewitnesses who might otherwise come forward to shed more light on the story. He also considers why corporate media often fixate on sex scandals to the exclusion of other crucial news coverage.
Well, I think one of the things that frightens pretty much anybody in Washington these days is to find yourself on the wrong end of this very powerful political machine that exists that can intimidate people, that can take away your career, that can really go after you. And I think one of the sad things that these pages seem to have picked up from their time in Washington is that you better not get on the wrong side of this group. So when they're facing this problem of having this congressman, in effect, come onto them with his emails and then later with his instant messaging, and I guess apparently in at least one case, it's now being alleged with direct contact, that the pages were very, very, very worried that if they did speak out, they would be subjected to this kind of character assassination. They'd become the victims a second time, that they'd be the target of this attack apparatus. And we're starting to get almost seeing that now that this has come out. One part, the Republican and right-wing media apparatus, has gone after the Democrats with what amount to suggestions based with apparently with no evidence that the Democrats had withheld this information until a time a month before the elections. We're also seeing some of the pages who have, over the past week or so, edged toward going public. being faced with people investigating their past and trying to figure out if they can be discredited. So I think this is not entirely paranoid in Washington to think that when you come out and go against this this majority control that we have in the House, the Senate, the White House of the Republicans, that you will face these kinds of attacks.
Do you think the Republican machine, as you refer to it, do you think they'll be successful in spinning this scandal to diminish it in some ways and have people out there question the Democrats and their role in breaking this story when it looks like right now there is no evidence that they have played any direct role?
Right. There is no evidence at all that the Democrats held this information till this point in late September, early October. That is what you're seeing in the talking points. I was on one of the right-wing radio shows the other day, and that's what I was hearing. These people were challenging me. Why didn't I look into this issue of why how the Democrats had manipulated this? But there's no evidence of that. So you're faced with this kind of attack always being on the offensive, as opposed to people just taking responsibility for things, dealing with it, moving on. There's this idea in Washington, and certainly within this machinery we see, of always trying to put anybody on the defensive who gets in your way. One of the odd things about this Republican machine that now dominates Washington, and controls the White House, controls the House, controls the Senate, controls the federal courts, controls a lot of the news media, is that it's always the victim. It always presents itself as the victim. It's always being picked on by some mysterious liberal powerhouse. And that's what we're seeing again here, is that the Republicans are trying to position themselves, at least with their base, at least with the gullible people that listen to these shows and take them to heart, that the Republicans are the victims here, not the kids. You know, it's not the fact that there's been this tremendous failure of protecting the Page program. It's that the Democrats, the mysterious Democrats, have somehow used this for political reasons.
Robert Perry, there are a whole set of scandals that the Republicans and the Bush administration are facing going into this November's congressional election. Among them, of course, the worsening problems in Iraq, the escalating violence there, the revelations about the national intelligence estimates saying that Iraq has caused more problems than it had ever solved, Bob Woodward's book and the revelations therein. The other issue, of course, is the gutting of the Constitution, with Congress basically legalizing torture and ripping habeas corpus out of the Bill of Rights. Why is the Foley scandal such a dominating force with the news media?
Well, it's a good question. I think anything that relates to sex has sort of has an appeal to our news media. We certainly have seen this sort of more trivialized nature of journalism develop over the years, certainly in the 90s when we had the O.J. Simpson case that took up so much attention. We had, of course, Bill Clinton's sexual shenanigans take up a lot of attention. Even recently, we've had sex murder cases taking up a lot of the public airways. So, you know, it does relate somewhat to the idea that many in the media have that this is what sells. However, I think they're really selling the American people short in many ways. There are many other issues that are important. Obviously, I've covered news for a long time, and there is an appeal to certain kinds of tabloid-style stories, and one can't deny it. But there's a lot more going on. You have, of course, as you mentioned, some of these major crises in the world, and Americans are not dismissive of those. Americans either who have friends or relatives involved in Iraq or Afghanistan certainly care a great deal about how those wars are being prosecuted and whether or not they should have been waged in the first place, especially in the case of Iraq. So you have this sort of selling the American people short, I think, about what's important. So when they waste their time or spend too much of their time on some of these tabloid stories, they're not going to give the American people the kind of knowledge and information they need to weigh how important it is to have a constitution that's protected, to have a foreign policy that makes sense, to understand the nuances of some of these issues. We went to war in Iraq. I think most Americans didn't know the difference between a Sunni and a Shia.
That was investigative journalist Robert Perry, winner of the George Polk Award for National Reporting. He is the author of Secrecy and Privilege, Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. Read his columns online at www.consortiumnews.com.
Three of the 15 seats that Democrats need to win to take back the House of Representatives are in the state of Connecticut. All three Republican incumbents, Christopher Shays, Nancy Johnson, and Rob Simmons, are facing stiff challenges from their Democratic opponents, Diane Farrell, Chris Murphy, and Joe Courtney, respectively. But the Democratic incumbents in the state's two other districts face no serious challenge to re-election. After Senator Joe Lieberman lost the Democratic primary to challenger Ned Lamont, Lieberman decided to run on his own party line, Connecticut for Lieberman. According to opinion polls, Lieberman is attracting far more support from Republicans than the endorsed Republican candidate Alan Schlesinger. Some political analysts believe that Senator Lieberman's independent run could bring more Republicans to the polls and help reelect all three Republican incumbent members of Congress. Into this scenario has stepped the Hilltop Brigade, Democrats from the two safe Democratic districts who are campaigning to boost the chances of their party's challengers. At a recent House meeting just outside New Haven, former Democratic Congressman Sam Gaidenson gave the brigade volunteers a pep talk. He represented the 2nd District in the state for 20 years, until he was defeated in 2000 by the incumbent Rob Simmons. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus attended the meeting and recorded his talk, from which this segment is excerpted, which focused on the political tactics of moderate Republicans fighting to retain their congressional seats.
The Republicans in Connecticut are great at being fake moderates. And Democrats, and liberal Democrats in particular, they always feel good if they can vote for a Republican, because that means they're not just partisan hacks, that they think about who they're going to vote for. Mr. Shays, who is very good at appearing to be a very open and progressive member of the Congress, spends much of his time, as many of these northern Republicans do, waiting till after the bell. What does that mean? Well, the president needs 218 votes. Once the president gets his 218 votes in the House, he has the majority. It doesn't matter what people who vote after that do. So northern Republicans will wait, as Mr. Simmons did on one bill. He waited 3 hours till he voted with the president. They couldn't get anybody else. He finally, you know, fell over for the president. But he waited 3 hours because they know it doesn't sell back home. So they're always looking for ways to say, they come back and say, well, I voted against the president. Yes. When did you vote against the president? After you already had the majority. What's happened in the last couple of weeks on the war is very instructive. Chris Shays has been to Iraq 13 times. Thought Rumsfeld was doing a fine job. The war was moving forward. Everything was going well. And then suddenly he took a 14th trip, and he was against the war. Kind of a miraculous awakening, you'd think. Well, let's see what happened in between, in that decision-making process. Well, when his 13th trip occurred, there hadn't been a Democratic primary in Connecticut yet. So on August 8th, there was a Democratic primary. And Ned Lamont beat the former vice presidential candidate and, for many years, the most popular politician in the state of Connecticut, Joe Lieberman, primarily on the war in Iraq. That kind of was a little wake-up call. And then he took the trip, and he came back, and he said, God, things have changed. Rumsfeld should resign, and we need a timeline. And I thought, well, that's not too surprising. Republicans had historically sold themselves as people of personal responsibility. You know, if a welfare mother got one extra cookie, they'd want to imprison her. You know, if they cheated on WIC, you know, they should be penalized. Personal responsibility. You screw up, you pay for it. How about Don Rumsfeld? He screwed up every part of this war. He made a mistake at every stage, at every decision. He made a mistake. And none of these Republicans who scream about personal responsibility ever called for his resignation until their political future was in danger. Mr. Simmons, in the 2nd District, was, you know, I'm in the CIA, I know what we have to do, we're staying hard the course, this is the right thing to do. And then two polls came out within about 7 or 8 days. Both of them had him losing. And all of a sudden, he was starting to talk about there should be some kind of deal. Nancy Johnson has done a two-step for her entire time in Congress. When she first got elected, we're in the middle of the war of the Contras, you know, when Ronald Reagan wanted to send, you know, troops down to have revolution in Latin America. And Nancy would vote with Ronald Reagan over and over again. But once she took a trip with George Miller, who was with me, one of the great opponents of the Reagan policy, and she'd come back to her district and say, oh, I just went to Latin America with George Miller. In her present campaign, the only ad she has on TV that I've seen in a moment is a bold-faced lie. You know, we've learned to be very nice about these things and try to talk about them more softly. What she says is that her Democratic opponent would like to have a system where it is impossible, where the U.S. government would be shackled and incapable of listening to terrorists plotting to blow up America. He wants to create a system so complicated we could never listen in on terrorists. You know what the present law is? The present law is they can listen to anybody they want. And then we created a compliant court for deal with these kind of issues. Then they have to send, you know, their lowest ranking lawyer to just drop a piece of paper in this court, which is there to say it's okay to have done what you did 14 days ago. That's how tricky the present system is. But the reality is this government can listen to anybody they really deem a threat to our national security if they change no existing law. Nancy's on television trying to frighten Americans into thinking this kid who's running against her is some guy going to shackle us in this fight over terrorism. The Democrats can't get rooms to hold meetings under this Republican Congress. Nancy Johnson, when she was on the Ethics Committee, bent the rules of the House to try to protect Newt Gingrich from being censured. These guys have brought the worst scandals on the House, and even worse than the thievery, they failed to do their fundamental responsibility. The future of this country cannot be left in the hands of a Congress that has been AWOL when it comes to oversight on one of its most critical responsibilities. Republicans always say, we don't need welfare, we don't need education, the federal government shouldn't do anything. Its main responsibility is defending America. Well, if the government's main responsibility is defending America, Congress's main responsibility is to do oversight to make sure they're doing it right. These guys have done it wrong time and time again, and the Congress hasn't had guts enough to ask question one.
That was former Congressman Sam Gaidenson, who until he was defeated in 2000, had represented Connecticut's 2nd District for 20 years. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.